I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. This can be the best of times and the worst of times for many artists. The internet has made the middleman obsolete, opening up access to a much wider and bigger audience. But if you're a musician, chances are you can't make a living off of downloads that have also changed touring and concert sales. Philadelphia has a vibrant art scene where competition for grants and funding can be intense. Artists generally don't have the literacy skills to make smart financial decisions. Join the club. Add to this the stereotype of the starving artist, and it can be tough to make a living as an artist. And that's our topic for today's Radio Times. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Kristen Thompson is a social researcher and organizer. For the past 14 years, she has worked with the Future of Music Coalition. That's a national nonprofit that advocates for musicians. And since 2010, she has co-directed the organization's Artist Revenue Streams, and that's a research project collecting data directly from U.S.-based musicians and composers to better understand the sources of their income. And Kristen Thompson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Also with us is Amy Smith, and she's founder, co-director of Headlong Dance Theater here in Philadelphia. She teaches workshops on financial literacy for artists around the country, and this is through the Creative Capital's Professional Development Program, and she actually helps artists with their tax preparation. And Amy Smith, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much.
You know, this region is seen and often described, including described by me, as really having this very thriving art scene. I think that's been one of the wonderful developments in the last generation or so. Has that translated, Amy, into artists more able to make a living because they're living in this thriving art scene?
To some degree, yes. I think there are artists who have benefited immensely from the thriving arts community, begetting more support for the arts community. So I count myself among them. I'm really proud and happy to be a working artist and a middle-class working artist. I own my own home. I have a husband and two kids.
Say,
yeah,
wow.
I know. And a lot of artists in Philadelphia, even dance and theater artists, own their homes and have achieved a measure of financial stability. But it's still really financially challenging to be a working artist, and it's certainly rare for artists to make all of their income from their art practice. So most artists are self-subsidizing with day jobs or spouses or kind of other ways of supporting their art.
And I do want to pick up on that from your perspective, Kristen. And I'm curious about the fact that Amy says, you know, she lives a relatively middle-class life. Is that possible here in Philadelphia for a lot of artists?
I would think so. And there's similar things going on in the music community. Philadelphia has some interesting benefits to it, most of all being in a good geographic location. So if you're an artist and a musician in particular, you can get to the core places where there's other music events happening, whether it's New York or D.C. Or other places. And it's also quite affordable in relative terms. So it can be possible.
Certainly compared to New York or San Francisco or probably even Boston. Right.
So you can have a place to rehearse and live and probably have another job for a while. So you can have some, you're going to probably, like Amy said, splitting your time for a while, at least especially at the beginning, amongst different income sources until something either gels and you can create a full-time career.
How has the internet, I mean, the internet has changed everything, but how has it changed the world for the artist, Amy?
Well, it's funny. For dance and theater artists, the internet has improved our ability to get our work out into the world, you know, to bring people to our shows. It's certainly easier to do that with an email than it is with postcards. but still, the bottom line is live theater, live dance, live art is live art, and you need people to come to it and be in the same room. And that's kind of the magic of dance and theater, is that we're all in the same room together. And that the internet can't replace that magic. You don't get the same sense of a performance watching a YouTube clip or Vimeo clip than you get from being in the room with the performing artists.
And Kristen, I would think for musicians, and we've heard from them over the years, is the internet has its benefits, but it also has its downsides as well. Mm-hmm. Help us understand that.
It's a really big conversation, but to think of it as a double-edged sword is probably the best way to sort of start the conversation, which is that the internet has solved a lot of the problems, the challenges, if you will, of sort of a pre-1998 version of the music industry, where it was very difficult to get your music manufactured and then distributed and in the retail stores and then to get paid for that. That whole mechanism was challenging unless you had some infrastructure, some expertise, and some money to help you get through it. Now it's those kind of problems, those kind of challenges are quite simple. There's lots of services out there that make it very easy to post your music, make it available publicly and in all those sort of digital stores. But now there's new challenges.
Yes.
You know, there's an enormous amount of music. It's very competitive. And the price point at which music used to be sold in sort of these sort of containers we called albums has now dropped down because you can also sell and purchase music digitally via downloads and also stream it. And those price points are very different.
In fact, it seems that it would be pretty hard to make a living as a musician just living off of digital or internet sales.
It would probably be, although, you know, there's some artists that can do that. It's just that one thing we did find in our Artist Revenue Streams project, which really was trying to capture, get a sense of what it was like for musicians at this point in time by gathering a lot of data directly from musicians and composers. Mm-hmm. And what we did find is that income from sound recordings, that thing that you are making available, is just one of many places, one of many income sources, oftentimes not the most the biggest one. It's usually a mixture of things, whether it's live performance money or income from licenses and things like that and merchandise that make up the mixture of revenue that most musicians rely on.
You said the word merchandise. I mean, is that sort of where the money is for a lot of musicians? T-shirts and things like that?
It depends on the artist's role and the genre they work in. For some musicians, it's not relevant at all. You know, there's lots of musicians out there for whom that kind of work is just not part of their day experience. But oftentimes, for bands that are on tour a lot, having merchandise available is a thing, the sort of tangible thing. And in fact, it's something that you can sell at your store, I mean, at your shows and also online, that is can't be downloaded for free, you know? So it's something that you can make and also customize in a way. You can really make things that are somewhat exclusive, if you will, and really appeal to different types of your audience.
You were nodding your head, Amy.
Yeah, there's something that musicians and performing artists share, and probably all artists, which is that it's a kind of a grand irony of being an artist, which is that everyone gets paid but the artist. You know, the whole infrastructure exists because of the work of the artists, the often invisibilized and radically under-resourced labor of the artists. But the artists aren't compensated for their labor adequately.
They call that trickle down, don't they?
Exactly. And my husband was a working musician for 20 years, Rich Kaufman, and he and Kristen know each other for a long time, and we used to kind of commiserate about that. Where, you know, he'd say, "Yeah, it's so ironic that the guy who runs the label gets a paycheck, and the guy who runs the sound studio gets a paycheck, and the A&R guy gets a paycheck, but I don't get a paycheck, even though I created the product that they're selling." And similarly in dance, you know, when you go do a performance, the TD and the you know soundboard op at the theater. You know, they're not like super well compensated, but they can rely on some relatively stable income from their profession and their work. And the artistic director of the venue is getting a paycheck, and the people who give away the money at the foundations are all nicely compensated. But the artists, without whom all of that wouldn't exist, are often really self-subsidizing or radically under-resourced.
Does that tell us or tell you something about how we view artists?
Yeah, I think our culture doesn't support artists, period. It's profound and it's problematic.
Do you think it's I hate this stereotype, but the stereotype of the quote-unquote starving artist, the idea that if you're an artist, you need to suffer.
Right.
You need to kind of feel the pain of your creative process.
Yeah, it's so, it's
which is
really
crazy
terrible
when you think
and
about
crazy.
It.
Yeah. And artists really internalize that cultural undervaluation or under-resourcing. There's this myth of, I'm lucky to be doing this, therefore I don't deserve to get paid.
And that's a thinking
that's
that the
a
artist
real
has.
Thinking that artists have. And it's deep. It really infiltrates all aspects of our ability to negotiate for fair pay, our ability to budget appropriately for our projects and for our work and for our lives. our ability to ask for money. It's really it's very, very challenging for a lot of artists.
Kristen, do artists, and we're speaking artists in the sort of broadest sense of the word, but do they need to think like entrepreneurs? I mean, to think about to think like someone that might has a small business, works for themselves, for
yes,
instance.
I do think so. And it's good to see artists and musicians start to embrace that more. And maybe it's because it's become more necessary to do that. But they do operate like small businesses in many cases. And that means doing things like understanding what income sources you have, including things like if we're going to do a fan funding campaign where we're trying to, in advance, collect money to support a record project or a tour, you know, how are we going to get this work done, and how much will those little prizes, the little gifts given to supporters going to cost us, and will this, you know, be enough money for us to do the project? So there's this whole budgeting sort of forecasting that involves some business skills and also just keeping track of everything that is important, because as much as, you know, we can talk about how much musicians and other artists make money, we also have to talk about the cost side, which is a huge part of whether it's possible to sustain a career.
Mm-hmm. Well, and just picking up on that, Amy, and as someone that does tax returns for artists, it's not like you get a weekly paycheck. So maybe you
Correct.
Have a money from a performance. Maybe you got a small grant somewhere. Maybe somebody, you know, a benefactor or someone threw some money your way. So you're cobbling together an income.
That's right. You're cobbling together an income. It's very unstable, which is great. I mean, it's not great. It's never great, but it's easier when you're 25 and single and don't have kids. And, you know, you could maybe move in with a roommate or something if you needed to. But it's really hard when you're 40 and you need a little more financial stability in your life and you're thinking about retirement and all of those
sure.
kinds of things. So it's those aspects of being an artist are really, really hard. And for some of us in the performing arts community, it's even more challenging. I would say actors probably have it the hardest. It's casting season and season announcing season right now. So one of my female actor friends posted something on Facebook about how many roles that there are for men and how few for women, and how all the female actors in town are kind of crossing their fingers and hoping they'll get two or three shows next season. And that's just really, really challenging. It's so hard to plan when the income is so small and so variable.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Amy Smith. She's founder, co-director of Headlong Dance Theater here in Philadelphia, and she teaches workshops on financial literacy for artists, and this is across the country through something called Creative Capital's Professional Development Program. Also with us is Kristen Thompson, and she has worked with the Futures of Music Coalition. And again, that's a national nonprofit. They advocate for musicians, and she's been collecting data about how musicians, composers make money, how they can better manage their money. And that's our topic for this hour of Radio Times. Give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Kristen Thompson and Amy Smith about what it takes to make a living as an artist in the 21st century. An explosion of comments on our Facebook page, and also calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Kristen, looking over some of these Facebook comments, people say, I need a rich benefactor, I need royalty, I need a subsidy. I mean, the message I'm getting is that I can't make money off the art that I'm doing, or perhaps the people coming to hear me perform, so I need someone to help me, sort of subsidize me.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sort of typical thinking, and is that the typical reality?
Well, I mean, for a few decades, this recorded music industry was really controlled by the big record labels, which still exist. And they really did have a lot of financial capital to invest in artists. And, you know, if you were signed to those big labels, they would ensure that your music was on the radio and it was in the big stores. And oftentimes you'd get a big cash advance. And sometimes you would never see any royalties after the fact for any sales. But, you know, they were a big bank account. And those deals still exist, but they're much more rare. And so now artists are searching around to try and find other sources of income to support their work, especially in advance of something being available. So how will I pay for to go and record something or go on tour? And so there, in addition to these interesting new ideas about crowdfunding or maybe going to find money from your friends or family, you can also – there's also a lot more corporate support for radio – for music in different ways. For example – there are organizations and companies that support certain tours or certain festivals, you know, being a sponsor. They can there's licensing, there's music licensing that happens, say, like when music is placed in an ad or in a movie. And there's whole companies that just help get music placed. But there's these licensing deals that are, you know, mostly money from the sort of business world.
Is that new for you think for a lot of musicians to think of the corporate or the business world as a source of revenue?
I think it's a changing. It had always been there, but now it's much more of they're looks like sort of reaching farther into the music community to find bands beyond the very tippy top of the music industry. So they're looking for really innovative and new music and willing to work with various artists and composers. So yes, this new relationship is developing.
Amy, let me talk to you about grants, because I know, you know, a lot of artists depend on grants. But it seems like that's not always the most stable source of income. You're competing with other artists. It's a limited amount of money. Help us take us into that world.
Yeah, it's a complex world. Headlong Dance Theater is a 501c3 nonprofit, so and we've been around for 20 years, and we've been very fortunate in the world of getting grants, both from local foundations and some national grants too from NEA and national funders like MAP and Creative Capital. So we've done well beyond our wildest dreams as far as being able to get grants to support our work, the creation process, which is expensive for dance and theater artists to bring all those people into a room working together. And it's tricky. My thinking about it has really changed in recent years as the funding priorities at William Penn Foundation and Pew have changed in ways that I think have been really challenging for the arts ecosystem in Philadelphia. So my own thinking has been that I want to step off the hamster wheel of applying for grants and needing to receive permission to make my work. So we're really focused in Headlong on trying to create a new model where we call it radical self-sustainability, where we're using the earned income from the Headlong Performance Institute, which is our education program, and our incubated artist program, and subletting our studios and things like that, a little bit of government support from the city and the state, and individuals who are, you know, I think a place where we can grow to support our work. So we don't need to gain permission from a foundation to create the work.
I was reading that just the numbers of nonprofits that have grown in Philadelphia is, I mean, it's
staggering.
It is staggering. It's sort of eye-popping. So you've got more nonprofits. You've got, I mean, we're just sort of coming out of a recession.
Right.
So there are many pressures, it seems, both on foundations, probably corporations, and also on the artists that are in need of some of this money.
Exactly. Yeah. And foundations, you know, scaled back their giving during the recession, which was understandable. They didn't have as much to give. Sometimes they really changed their priorities in directions that I can't argue with. You know, they're like, well, we have to fund hunger and homelessness more than we have to fund the arts. And I really understand that. And their money is theirs to give however they think appropriate. But it really those changing priorities really did have a detrimental effect on the arts community. And there is a trickle down in the arts community where, you know, if Headlong gets a grant, we can hire Jamil Kosako and Devin Emery and Kate Watson-Wallace to perform in our piece and to create the piece with us. When we don't get those grants for a few years in a row, Jamil Kosako and Devin Emery move to New York.
Right.
And that's a loss for our community because those are two really amazing performers and creators that I want to have in Philadelphia.
Well, I wonder, Kristen, too, just sort of, again, broadly speaking, I know you work mostly with musicians, but do most artists have to have a day job or, you know, be teaching or waiting tables or doing something in order to support their art? Or are more of them maybe making money off of their creative endeavors than we might think?
We certainly try to figure that out through our Artist Revenue Streams project. It's hard to say how it's changed. I mean, what we did find when just doing research was, especially with the musician community we were researching, we could find a certain number of people who were, quote-unquote, full-time musicians or composers. Right. It's hard to know whether the landscape is changing to the point where it makes it hard to be that person over the last 5 to 10 years. Sort of personally, I know lots of musicians who are very, very busy doing music and touring. But then, they'll have to come home and have a job between tours. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they're doing freelance work that's not place-based, like they're doing something on the internet or something like that. So oftentimes it's a balance, or it's wearing many hats at once to try and make sure it works.
And again, you have a very visual response about the many, how many hats do you wear?
We all wear so many hats. Yeah, I mean, I'm so lucky to be a working artist. I get a salary from Headlong Dance Theater, and I teach in the Headlong Performance Institute, and I love all of that work, and that's artistic. But then I also do the tax preparation for artists, which is mission-based for me, but it is, I obviously have to charge for my work. And then I teach these financial literacy workshops, and I was doing a little bit of adjuncting, and I think the adjunct teaching is something a lot of artists have done historically. The environment for that has changed, too, so much. I feel like being an adjunct is such an exploitative environment for artists, and one of many challenging places for artists to try to get income. So that's gotten harder, right. I think, as artists have a harder time getting those adjunct positions, and they pay so poorly. Most dance and theater artists wear many hats and support their art practice with day jobs. A lot of actors are standardized patients, and there's the classic, waiting tables or working as a barista, or, people really cobble together lives and subsidize their artistic practices with other kinds of work.
Well, we are talking about how to make a living as an artist in the 21st century. That's Amy Smith. And also with us, Kristen Thompson. And we have a lot of callers that want to join the conversation. Let me see what Kate from West Philadelphia has to say. Kate, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Hi, Amy and Kristen. As an illustrator and writer, who in the past I had been kind of doing it as a side project, but now I've kind of put 100% of myself into it to see if I can really get someplace.
Mm-hmm.
I'm struggling with tax preparation, and usually when you look for a tax preparer, they look at you as a small business and charge you accordingly. And I was wondering if either of you knew of some good resources that were either free or low cost for help with tax preparation specifically to creative industries.
For creative industries. Yeah, I'm going to toss that first to you, Amy.
Yeah, I mean, I do tax prep mostly because I started helping my friends, and then they had friends that needed help, and they had friends that needed help. And now between myself and my tax prep partner, we probably have 150 clients or something, and it's ever growing. So please don't call me. No, I'm joking. But there are some places you can go to for help. I just did a tax workshop at the Corso Center, which is an entrepreneurship center based at the University of the Arts. They also, I think, have partnerships with Drexel and Curtis and places like that. So you should check out the Corso Center,
Corzo,
and they have one-on-one consultations with experts in different fields too. And I do those office hours with them. And there are definitely like service organizations and foundations that offer support, like the Leeway Foundation or the Center for Emerging Visual Artists. Places like that will often have like workshops for about tax preparation for artists.
Kate, good luck and thanks for calling in. Anything you want to add to that, Kristen? We're good. Let me see what Megan from Norristown has to say. Hi, Megan. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I'm a harpist and a vocalist, actually, and I do freelance work full time. I'm so lucky to be able to say that. It's been a project through the years. The first year out of school, I really didn't know really what I was doing, but every year you just build and you learn, and it's been a great process. But it's one that I think can be aided by music schools if they had more business courses, especially for seniors and graduate students, so that they had a leg up as they were going into the industry.
It's a great comment, Megan, and I see some Facebook comments or some social media comments as well about why don't they teach this stuff in art school. Mm-hmm. I'm going to toss that first to you, Kristen.
I do know that the music conservatories, which have focused so heavily on performance and really getting the, you know, really well-developed performers trained, that they're now embracing and starting to build into their curricula more marketing, more even social media strategies, more business management, business affairs, so that they're graduating students who are better prepared for a lifetime that may not be part of just being part of an institution that takes care of all those things. So I'm glad to see it. I think that it's changing right now. But I think there's more opportunities out there.
Yeah, schools need to catch up, Amy, on this.
Yeah. I really think I really wish more colleges and universities took seriously their obligation to prepare their students for the world that they're going to enter. Mm. If they're serious about being artists, and I think they should be serious about being artists, I think the schools have an obligation to prepare them with classes and with mentoring opportunities, paid internships, you know. So I really advocate for that. I try to teach it as much as I can when given the opportunity. But I think it's really important.
Is there anything wrong with having a day job? I mean, sort of being an artist by night and teacher by day or professor by day. Is there anything shameful about that?
I think artists feel shame about it. They wish they could say, and you know, when I hear that your caller, the harpist, saying that she's a full-time musician, that's so great. I want more artists to be able to claim that and to be able to say that and to be supported adequately so they can be full-time working artists. Our culture deserves that. Our culture needs that. But there's still no shame because our culture undervalues the arts so much. Of course, artists are going to be supporting their art practice with day jobs, and it's not shameful. It shouldn't be. Artists shouldn't be ashamed of however they subsidize their artistic practice.
Do you think that it's just harder to, or can you live off an audience, whether the audience is listening to a concert, Kristen, or whether the audience is coming in to see a show, or perhaps the audience is going to Headlong Theater to see a dance performance? Is that where the money is?
Well, when we did our artist revenue streams work, live performance was the biggest source of gross income. And that was part of the survey results. But we also did these financial case studies. And it was important for us to do them. We did six of them. And some of them, one was a jazz band leader, and one was a jazz sideman, and one was an orchestral player, and one was a side vocalist person. So it was very different. Their revenue streams were very different from person to person, but it also gave us a chance to look at their financial books and look at the expense side, because the jazz band leader may be grossing the most money, but that person, a jazz band leader, is typically the person that takes the risk, and they pay the sidemen and they pay the travel expenses. So it goes back to this whole thing about having to manage your cost side and also, you know, be able to budget things so that you can make sure if you're doing these big projects that you come home with, you know, enough money.
Some money in your pocket.
Enough money in your pocket and also enough money to sort of keep it going.
Well, I'm thinking too about dance or performance theater, that kind of thing, where, yes, even if you sell out, does that support a theater group or a dance group?
The short answer is no. I think for even the big regional theaters in town, they maybe have like a 50-50 earned versus contributed, you know, ticket sales versus contributed income from people and from foundations. There's really no way for performing arts for the ticket sales to cover the costs of the creation, because, like I said, the creation process is expensive because there's so many collaborators and people involved, and you need to rent studio space. And so I don't think that's a model we should be aspiring towards, that ticket sales cover the costs of the work.
Even though I think as someone who does go to performances, I mean, sometimes it's expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, to sit in the theater is expensive.
Right.
You know, you want to,
where does that money go to?
But you're saying there's so much invested up front.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the cost of creating a work of performance, you know, you could do it on the cheap for, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 if you're paying everybody adequately. But, you know, we've made projects in Headlong that were $150,000 to over years to create a piece of performance that has multiple performers, multiple designers, multiple, you know, studio rent, all of the, and then just keeping the doors open, keeping the lights on
sure.
in the office.
We have a Facebook comment from Evelyn. She says there need to be many more ways to distribute and get paid, and many more ways for your work to be copied, which is an interesting comment, because I think for a lot of artists, they feel like, this is mine, I don't want it to be copied. But Kristen, perhaps that is a way to think about.
Well, sure. I mean,
it's
a point that is you know, based in truth that, you know, making your music, if I'm just going to talk about music, but making your music available in as many places as possible and making it something where you find your fan where the fan is, you know? So you want to make sure lots of folks have their music on iTunes. But there's other platforms like Bandcamp where you can you know, post your music and set a price, and they include variable pricing, which is fascinating.
Wow, that's interesting.
And then there's other places where you can post your music that's essentially free, like YouTube or SoundCloud, where perhaps you have another reason to post it there, whether it's building an audience or, you know, just getting a profile or directing people, your fans, to other things. So having your music on a number of platforms is... It depends on the artist. You know, if your strategy is to be everywhere, then it's part of your work to figure out what is going to be the most useful and practical places to be.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about how to make it as an artist, how to make it financially as an artist. And again, our guests are Kristen Thompson, and she has worked almost 15 years with the Future of Music Coalition. That's a nonprofit, and she has been collecting data about how musicians and composers make their money and how to better understand their sources of income. Also with us is Amy Smith, founder and co-director of Headlong Dance Theater in Philadelphia, and she teaches workshops on financial literacy for artists through Creative Capital's Professional Development Program. We have a lot of people that want to join our conversation. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Amy Smith and Kristen Thompson about how to make it financially as an artist in the 21st century. Let me go back to you, Amy. We were just talking about this during the break, and perhaps even going back to some of the financial literacy that you teach, which is, yes, you have to cover, hopefully, your short-term expenses, but then you have to think about the future. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard for even non-artist people to think about the future. But if your income is not predictable, how do you suggest people do that?
Yeah, it's really tough. And that's why I think a lot of artists leave the field prematurely, because those challenges get to be too much. And I wish that would stop, because I want people to stay in the field, stay working as artists throughout their lifetimes if that's what they want to do. So that's what I kind of teach and preach with the financial literacy work, is acknowledging the value of your time and the real cost of your work, making what we call real cost budgets, which is something I really try to emphasize to the young people that I teach at the Headlong Performance Institute, which is to not invisibilize the value of your work, to really take it seriously and say, this project is going to – I have to raise this much money for
right.
this project, because this is what it costs in my time and the hard costs.
So really think of the time that you spend as an artist as having
value. As having value. Again, this kind of internalized, you know, I'm lucky to be an artist. That dynamic is so damaging to artists. So there's that, just kind of like figuring out how to pay for the project and then working to create that project, which we're going to do anyway as artists. You know, we love being artists. We're going to make that project. But then there's often a moment for artists when they're in their, you know, 40s or 50s where they're like, oh, crap, I forgot to think about my own financial future, my retirement. Like, will I be able to retire? When will I be able to retire? Will there be any money for me at the at that stage of my life? Or things like, you know, putting a kid through college.
Sure.
Or, I mean, those things are really, really, really challenging for artists because our income is so unstable. And frankly, there's a whole generation of young artists right now that are saddled with such oppressive student loan debt. They're having a hard time even kind of getting out of the gate as artists. And they're going to be even they're going to have an even harder time with some of those long-term financial issues about, you know, home ownership, kids in college, retirement, all of that. So, you know, it obviously varies so much person to person, but
do you suggest just squirreling away just small amounts of
money? Absolutely. I often talk about compound interest, which puts everyone to sleep. But, you know, interest earning interest, like if you can start saving young at, you know, in your 20s for even just having like a little buffer of savings to guard against some unexpected difficult financial difficulties. And then, you know, if you don't end up needing that, you can start squirreling away. Even, you know, I know a young actor who just said, realize, like, I can put $25 a week into an IRA. And by the time I retire, that'll be thousands and thousands of dollars. I was like, yay.
Light bulb went off, right?
Makes me so happy.
Let me see what Boston has to say, calling us from South Philadelphia. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Sure, go ahead.
My question was touched on a little bit, but I'm a poet who, you know, works a day job to get by. And there's this expectation that when you're a writer working in academia that doesn't really pay well with publishing, you should work as a professor. And, like, what do you do when the only profession anybody thinks you can do is not well paid?
I was going to say adjunct. We have done whole hours on adjunct, and there's a lot of interest in this, but I'm going to toss that to you, Kristen. I mean, this is a whole other kettle of fish.
Yes, it is another kettle of fish. I mean, I would think, I don't know, there's potentially other places, you know, poets are great writers. There's a whole world of writing that happens on the internet that is in need, although, gosh, the pay on some writing, like by the word count, pay doesn't seem great either. So perhaps there's, you know, work in other fields where good writing with some flourish is important. And, you know, it's funny because prior to my Future Music Coalition work, I ran an independent record label. And there's things that you develop running a business that become useful later. For example, you know, I'm pretty good at organizing events, or I can, you know, do some accounting. So sometimes these learned skills can help you find work that supports your other things.
Yeah, not always easy. Anything you want to add to that, Amy?
Yeah, no, it's so true. Like, if you could find a day job that actually helps you with your art practice, you know, it's so I worked for a long time doing kind of business management for a private investigation firm. And so I learned QuickBooks and Excel and all of these great skills that I applied to Headlong. And that was so valuable to me. It wasn't just the paycheck I was getting from my day job. It was the skill set that I was learning, the people that I met, and vice versa. I think a lot of artists don't realize how skillful they are, how good they are at project management, time management, team building, teamwork, collaboration. Like, that word collaboration is so hot in the business community. We do it all the time as artists. And we need to own that and name that and say our time has value, both in our art practice and to anyone that might be interested in hiring us.
Thanks for the call. Let me read an email from, looks like Carell. Is it possible there are just too many artists and musicians out there? Is a mess of mediocrity fighting for the revenue of better artists when they should be taken out of the market and put back to being hobbyists? A bit of a loaded question there, but do we have too many artists? Is there a glut of artists? Kristen?
Well, there certainly is a lot of music, and the barriers to the entry to the marketplace are very low right now. So if you have, say, $50 and you want to upload your music, or even less, you can get it up there. Although, yes, that means there's a ton of music, and you're also not only competing with whatever came out this week, but all of recorded music's history, because it's mostly available on the internet, plus all the other things that can occupy our time. But the one good thing about the internet and all these things is that it's really difficult for really great music to just go undiscovered.
Oh, interesting. So if it's good, someone will find it and spread the word?
Yeah, I think so. And I am always impressed, especially, you know, in the past 5 to 10 years, about the quality and interesting nature of new music that's coming out of all sorts of genres. And I guess maybe competition breeds really exciting, interesting new developments. It doesn't mean that it makes it any easier.
Sure.
It's just that it's there's a lot going on.
Let me see what Mo from Pennington has to say. Mo, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Hi.
Hi there.
I'm a commissioned painter and sculptor. I've been doing this for 45 years full time. And I feel sorry for a lot of the young artists or novices who fall into this vanity press type trap. They're paying $25, $35 a fee to try and get into an exhibit. And really, it's just a money-making scheme. If 1,000 people give them $35 and are only accepting 100 or 50 people for the exhibit, it's just a money-making, taking advantage of them. There's so many ways to make a living. The artists just have to be creative, just as creative in their business ideas as they are in their canvas or their sculpture or whatever. I feel that most of the conventional venues are not the way to go. They're just... they don't pay as a business venture, and you have to think that way if you want to make a living at it. If you're a hobbyist, it's different.
Sure. No, Mo, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm going to give Amy Smith a chance to respond.
Yeah, I really I hear that, and I appreciate what you say, Mo, about, like, I feel like artists should never have to pay to have their work seen. You know, sometimes, like, with dance showcases or, you know, you have to send money in to be considered for a you know, an opportunity, a residency or whatever. I always tell younger artists, I would never do that. And
oh, is that
I don't
right?
think you should do that. No, 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 no. If you have to pay to be considered, it's not a real opportunity. The money should be flowing the other way to the artist from the person offering the opportunity. And yeah, I love what you say about you need to be as creative with your business thinking as you are with your art making. And that, you know, that's, if nothing else, I think the message that I try to send young people that I teach at the Headlong Performance Institute and elsewhere is, like, you know, use the creativity. You already have the skills and the ability to figure this stuff out. You just need to feel empowered to self-educate so that you can understand how to build a sustainable life for yourself as an artist. But I really want to emphasize that to any young artist listening. You can figure this out. You can do this. You're smart enough already. You have the skills.
I think for some artists listening to us, they might be saying, I don't want to do it. I mean, maybe
it's
I can,
hard.
But I don't want, that's not why
it's
I became
hard.
An artist.
But, you know, the alternative, I love my life, you know, and what really makes being an artist so awesome, especially in Philadelphia, is the community of artists here. I mean, we have a fabulous, rich, diverse, interesting, wonderful community of artists in Philadelphia. And there's so much interaction. There's so much collaboration across genres. I mean, it's just, it's a great place to live. Mm. It's a great place to be an artist. Like, that's what makes it all worthwhile is the community.
Mo, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Jack from Bucks County has to say. Jack, go ahead. You're on the air.
Marty, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My day is never complete unless I listen to your show.
Oh, you're so nice. Thanks, Jack.
My comment is I make my living as an actor, and as your guest just commented on, the community here in Philadelphia is very supportive. Recently, I had a medical situation, and it was my actor friends who came to my rescue.
That's
but
nice.
My point is, my sister, who's a doctor, says to me all the time, she says, Jack, I don't understand how you don't know next week where your next paycheck is coming from. She says, I couldn't live like that. I have to know that, you know, where the money's coming from. And I say, Bonnie, I said, doctors and lawyers and Indian chiefs don't understand that the bottom can drop out on anybody at any time. But actors are the only ones, or not actors, artists are the only ones who know that when the bottom drops out, you just pick up your kit, you move on down the road, you just go to the next audition, and off you go. And that's the way it is.
Well, Jack, you know, first of all, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. We weren't sure if it was going to have a happy ending or a sad ending from your story. No, I hear you. Let me give Amy and Kristen a chance to respond.
Yeah, Jack, I just want to second what you say about the community being so supportive here in Philadelphia. I'm so proud and honored to be part of this community of dance and theater artists in Philly. And we do really take care of each other in times of need. But yeah, the bottom line is it's very unstable, and especially actors, you know, you go out and audition for 20 things and maybe get one, or, you know, maybe next season there aren't any plays that are looking for a young black female, or, you know, I mean, it's just really, really tough, depending on how what your type is, how long you've been in the field. It can have nothing to do with how talented you are as an actor. So it is just really, really unstable. But there, I feel like the work is so important and so necessary to our culture that we just keep doing it. We have to figure out how to keep doing it. How to support it better, definitely, but we're going to keep doing it.
Well, Kristen, what I hear is a kind of, a built-in anxiety. I mean, not that everyone else has a secure job and they know that their paycheck is going to come in every week or two, but nonetheless, the kind of built-in anxiety of being an artist.
I would think so that, you know, with the musicians, there's oftentimes an anxiety around, hey, we're going to go and record this music and press it up and make it available and also go on this tour, and fingers crossed people will show up for the shows and people will buy it and they'll like it or they won't. You know, like there's this anxiety around, will it actually anybody ever notice? Because, you know, there's this insane competition for people in the media to write about it and do reviews and have it get radio airplay. All those things that are important parts of this ecosystem that make music popular, if you will. So there's a lot of anxiety that's always been there. But now it's harder to imagine what the, there's this financial component that's much more risky because there's not this guaranteed, like, moment. So there's a lot of anxiety out there about having it all function, especially all function in a timely fashion so it all works.
So it all works out in the end. A Facebook comment from Mia saying, I've been a musical performer in Philadelphia for the last 20 years, and for the last 8 years I've made a living at it. I have learned that in this business there are no empty positions waiting to be filled. You must carve out your own place in it. And she's a musician. You're a performer. You agree?
Absolutely. Yeah. I call that finding your niche or creating your niche. And in some ways, that's one of the best things about being an artist is whatever kind of freak weirdo you are, like what makes you unique is what will actually be kind of your guiding light or your, it makes you special. Mm. It makes you different from other people in the world. And if you make your art about that, instead of trying to be like everybody else or conform to some kind of commonly understood types, that can be a real asset for an artist. But yeah, you do have to create your own opportunities financially and artistically. And that is kind of the new model for artists in this century is this kind of entrepreneurialism, this kind of creative thinking about how to create a sustainable art practice.
Well, and I hate to end on a down note, but I'm also thinking about those artists that might be listening that they couldn't make it. They could not make it happen. They couldn't make a living. And it doesn't mean that their art wasn't good or that they weren't talented or creative. But, for whatever reason, Kristen, it didn't work out for them.
I mean, there are it's hard. It's been a difficult part of the landscape for even prior to the internet. It was always fun to be in bands, but sometimes you hit a ceiling quickly about how sustainable that career was. So there are new challenges now for musicians and composers that involve really big economic issues as far as access and competition and things like that. With Future of Music Coalition, in addition to doing this type of research, we make sure that musicians think of themselves as stakeholders in these policy conversations that are happening about copyright, about media consolidation, about net neutrality, so that because we realize that this is a big ecosystem and that musicians are not only engaging in it, but also stakeholders in the future.
On that note, my thanks to the both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Kristen Thompson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's with the Future of Music Coalition. Amy Smith, thank you very much as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. She's founder, co-director of Headlong Dance Theater in Philadelphia. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times and you can carry on this conversation on our homepage or on our Facebook page. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.